This is the BBC.
I'm Philip Dodd. Thanks for downloading this edition of Radio 3's Arts and Ideas discussion programme, Free Thinking. And in this programme, we're looking at machines and man, war, painting and death. Hello. He had the eyes of an unsuccessful rapist, was an old volcano of the right, was the greatest portrait painter, not only of his age, but of all ages. Just three verdicts on Wyndham Lewis: painter, polemicist, novelist, official war artist, and satirist.
William Shakespeare lived in a savage time, a very savage time indeed, quite unlike ours, in which, though we drop a bomb or two upon each other and starve each other to the bone, both in peace and in war, we have rarely attained to a remarkable degree of innocuous politeness. Bombs there may be, but there are no black eyes.
Wyndham Lewis speaking in 1938, and later we look back on this self-proclaimed rebel as a new show opens at the Imperial War Museum North. Also, we have a postcard from a new generation thinker on the opportunities as well as the constraints that death provides us with. But we begin with a lively, maybe testy conversation with a man many believe is the greatest chess player of all time, the Russian Garry Kasparov. He was a small player in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Empire. He defeated the official Soviet master, Karpov, as perestroika blossomed and he wanted to make and keep money for himself. He's now an opponent of President Putin and lives in the US. But he is famous not primarily because of his victories, but because a computer, Deep Blue, defeated him in 1997, heralding for some an age when machines would rule the world. Kasparov, in his new book, Deep Thinking, Where Machine Intelligence Ends and Human Creativity Begins, will have none of the gloom that overtakes some people when they imagine a world of thinking machines. The book broods on the implications of his encounter with Deep Blue and its corporate backer, IBM, but also reflects more generally on how technological change has always shaken up the human world, only for us to make our peace with the new world it creates. This is the future that awaits us as long as we are not neo-Luddites. He was born in Baku, Azerbaijan, in 1963, and when we met, I asked him about that time.
It was the moment of technological optimism in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. It was the moment of the space race between the USSR and the United States, and people had great expectations about the future. If you read science fiction of that period, it's full of the predictions about us flying not just to the moon or to other planets of the solar system, but way beyond that. And reading the scientific forecasts for next 50 years, one could imagine that we'll have flying cars and many other great things, which we don't.
Did that affect you? Do you remember as a child, did you have a sense that technology would open doors? Did you believe that? Because Baku is not Moscow.
It's an interesting question, because the answer will be yes and no. Because the moment you said technology today, for my kids, for instance, technology means iPhones, Androids, computers, Skype, internet. Technology in the 60s mainly was about space travel. It's about us speeding up. It's about us conquering the outer space or deep oceans. Very few people could predict these modern means of communication. So that's why we could say that technological advance in the 60s had a different shape in the future.
It's just because as I read this book, somehow you and technology go together, like love and marriage. So there's an extraordinary moment in the book when you say when computers, and I'm not now talking about Deep Blue, but just when the presence of computers, they sideline an older generation of chess players.
Yes, computers sideline older generations, not of just chess players, but of representatives of any profession, because computers have changed and keep changing our work ethics. And we could see that a child with iPad today is far more effective than an experienced programmer with a PC 20 years ago.
And I'm very interested, which I assume is true because you tell me, which is that an app on the phone now, a chess app
on
the phone.
Free chess app.
A free chess app is more powerful than Deep Blue.
Yes, I would say it's stronger than Deep Blue. There could be a competition, but if you look at your laptop and a free chess engine on the laptop, far more powerful than Deep Blue. Also, it's more powerful than other supercomputers of the beginning of the 21st century. The pace of this development is phenomenal, but also there's a knowledge. It's not just sheer speed, because Deep Blue was much faster. It could make up to 200 million positions per second, an amazing speed even today, set aside 1997. Your laptop could probably reach a speed of 5-6 million positions per second, still amazing. But the quality of the chess program is so much sophisticated.
Okay, so there are two elements. There are always two elements to technology. There's what the technology does, and you're right, the app can do all kinds of things, but there's who owns the technology. So part of what I'm interested in you is IBM owned Deep Blue. And, you know, there are whole kinds of ways in which you skirt the issue. You don't think they were corrupt. You don't think they cheated you. But they bent the rules.
Yes, they bent the rules. I have to say that. So they follow the letters of our contract, but not the spirit. Because clearly, when you keep raising issues and create tension, only one player in this competition, a human one, could be affected. But again, it was my mistake that I paid very little attention to the fine print of this contract, not looking for little details. For instance, the Deep Blue games would be available, but fine print officially played, and Deep Blue played no games officially outside of the lab, which meant that by the beginning of the match, I have literally faced a black box, a machine that provided no information about its development, its playing style. So I had to walk in the darkness, relying on my common sense and making educated guesses about machine's decision-making pattern.
And there was a brilliant moment in the book, which I hadn't understood, which is IBM programmed the computer to hesitate.
They knew that they would be playing not just a chess player, but a very real one, you know, flesh and blood, Garry Kasparov, with his strengths and weaknesses. And they realized that by programming what you call hesitation moments, they could mislead me. Again, that was possible because I had zero information about Deep Blue. And again, I had to rely on my senses. And if I received wrong information about the way Deep Blue was making decisions, that could in turn lead to my own mistakes.
So what I want to ask you, and this is when I want to worry away about your technological optimism, it's always who owns it. The technology is morally neutral. Who owns it is the issue. And who owns it in the present? You spend a lot of time, as somebody as clever as you would now, speaking to business schools, speaking to Silicon Valley. These are not neutral agents. These have their own interests.
Business or political players are never neutral, by definition.
So the optimism of yours should be curbed by the recognition that the users of this technology can be corrupt as well as celebratory.
That's history of human race. Always technology served the powerful, and there were many moments where new technology, breakthrough innovations, helped wrongdoings, helped evil.
But do you think that's true now? So let me give you an example. The people who vote for Trump, the people who vote for Putin, are partly those who feel disenfranchised by this version of globalization.
Okay, but please, you know, just don't compare.
No, I didn't compare them.
But you said people did vote for Trump, and many of them were misled. Now, as for people who quote-unquote voted for Putin, that's a different story.
May be, but he is popular in Russia.
I don't know. I don't know. Hitler was popular. Stalin was popular. If you run a public opinion poll in Pyongyang today, North Korea, Kim Jong-un will be very popular, 100%
plus. Putin is not North Korea, nor is Russia. This is not a defense of it, but North
Korea
is not Russia, Russia is not North Korea.
Exactly. But Russia is heading in this direction. But let's go back to the technology and who owns it. It's a classical dilemma of the free world, security and privacy. And now it has a new angle because our information is available on the internet. it's a new twist.
But it can be commodified. That's
exactly.
My issue.
But but we like it this way because it's so convenient. No, we like it. It's so much information is available, but it's not a one-way street. It's a two-way street. Now, the difference is that if you look at Google and other multinational corporations collecting your data, it's not KGB. My prime concern today is not about citizens of the free world, of the United Kingdom, the United States, Germany, France, but more about people who live in Russia, in Iran, forget North Korea, there's no internet there, China, Turkey, Venezuela, and many other places where collecting your data could be not just detrimental for your financial interests, but could lead to a real threat to your well-being and even your life.
And the response to that is not only but also, you're absolutely right, but in addition to that, this technology is generating in its present forms massive inequalities, which is part of the reason Trump gets into power.
But it's not just about the jobs being lost. It has been happening across human history. And we saw many revolts in this country in the 19th century, Luddites. They believed machines were evil because they were threatening jobs. And we could see the same happening, the same economic effect happening across the 19th and 20th century. The difference today that machines are coming after people with college degrees, political influence, and Twitter accounts. But I think it's a natural cycle, and there's nothing unusual about it.
But it's what we do with the cycle. Let's concede your natural cycle. The point is, but what we do with it.
But it's
do we leave it to Silicon Valley to own?
No. We have to think about people, not about jobs being lost, because jobs will be lost anyway. And it's very important to find a way that this new technology will generate economic growth and will create sustainable new jobs. We have to look at the big corporations, and I believe that we need more regulations because we live in a free world, and we definitely can impose certain rules on Googles of this world to make sure that the data they collect will serve us and not will work against us. And this is a much bigger problem. It's not just science. It's not just technology. It's a societal problem.
No, it's a societal problem.
It's a political problem. But my point is that let's accept the inevitable. It's the technological progress cannot be stopped. If we try to slow it down, we are helping Trumps of this world because they will be always benefiting from people's concerns and people's frustration. So sooner we can move the cycle ahead, we'll reach a point where enough growth will be generated to help people who are left behind. It's also a problem that the new technology and more sophisticated medicine and diet help people to live longer. They can stay active for a longer period of time. So they want to be engaged, but it's more difficult to get adjusted. So there's so many interesting elements
of this
conundrum.
There are moments when the boy from Baku is still here, the technological
optimist. I'm 54. I'm no longer a boy from Baku. Yes.
No. Yeah. I mean, you were a boy. I want to go back as we move towards the end to you and chess and computers. You're very good at resisting the notion that a brain is like a computer, which is the old model.
I think it's a very primitive model, and that's the one of the ideas of my book was to help people to look at all these problems from a logical point of view, not to be overwhelmed by these dystopian concepts of the Terminator, the Skynet. Obviously, there are threats, but I believe future is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And we have to be optimistic and we have to look for every technology, as you said, neutral, agnostic, a coin with both sides and see how we can benefit from that. And our brain should always be relevant.
Okay, what is our brain, though? Because you spent more time wrestling with a sophisticated piece of technology than most of us.
But the brain issue, I think, does not belong to the domain of technology. It's more of a philosophy. The fact is, we don't know how it functions, and maybe it's good news.
No, we don't, but because it isn't technology, because it is philosophy, because this is a book about, as it's subtitly called, Where Machine Intelligence Ends.
And human creativity begins.
So is creativity what you most value and what you think in the end computers will not be able to imitate?
Yes, I think we can consider creativity being one of the unique human qualities of dealing with the unknown. Because I'm convinced that anything that we do and we know how we do, machines will do better. The question is that many things we do without knowing how we do them. That's where our creativity plays a crucial role. And that's what, in my view, will help us to stay on top of the game and not to become redundant.
Chess has got a very long history. Does it have a very long future?
Today, 20 years since my famous match with Deep Blue, many more people playing chess than ever. The United States today, it's still the leading country for innovations. And it's a real chess boom in the United States. There's so many kids are playing chess, and the U.S. millennial team is the best in the world. Chess is immensely popular. But it's not just America. It's across the world. So, you look at other places.
But the way in which, as economic power shifts, cultural power shifts, will it inevitably, chess now, move to be the place in China and India? Are they going to produce in 30 years the great chess champions?
Let's not forget that in places like China and Japan, there are own versions of chess. That's also a part of the cultural heritage. So it's more difficult. For instance, Japan, I think it's impossible to have chess substituting shogi, which is a Japanese game that has been played for centuries. I could see more chess being played around the world. I could see the rise of chess in Africa, for instance. But at the end of the day, I don't see a clear connection between economic growth and number of kids playing chess. To the contrary, for instance, in the United States, you could see that kids from lower social strata, they are just more aggressive because chess offers them a new opportunity.
Garry Kasparov and his book Deep Thinking is out now. Once upon a time, Wyndham Lewis was remembered as an artist of the machine age, a vorticist, the founder of the magazine Blast, someone who was as in love with machines as the Italian Marinetti. More recently, at an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery, he was recast as a great portrait painter of figures from Edith Sitwell to T.S. Eliot. Now, as Britain is immersed in a four-year remembrance of the First World War, Lewis is given another outing, one that places the art, he was an official war artist, next to the novels and other writing in a show subtitled Life, Art, War. There are certainly some who think that novels like Tar and The Revenge of Love, a novel attacking communists in Spain, suggest his greater contribution is to literature rather than to art. To discuss Lewis and war art, I'm joined on the line from Salford by the exhibition curator from the Imperial War Museum North, Richard Slocum, by the art historian Anna Gretzner-Robbins, and the painter John Keane, who was an official war artist in the First Gulf War. Richard, is part of the interest in him that he's hard to pigeonhole?
Well, yeah, certainly. We would begin the exhibition with a quote that Lewis made around about the 1940s when he sort of describes what he is. And it's more than just an artist. It's a novelist, it's a journalist, it's a soldier, it's a war artist. There's so many facets to Lewis. I mean, I don't really think there's a comparable artist, you know, in Britain of his time who is so diverse in the things that he does, basically.
Okay. Anna, that well may be true. On the other hand, D.H. Lawrence did all those things as a novelist.
Well, quite. And I do think that Lewis is a considerable artist, an art maker, and that this is something that is often not considered in the way that it might, simply because he did so many other things. And that if we take the words away and forget them for a moment and simply look at the work, it's absolutely fantastic.
And John, you were an official war artist at the time. Did you go back and look at Lewis's work? I don't know what war artists do if they go and, as it were, plagiarise other ones.
No, I didn't. He was not someone I particularly considered, and in fact didn't really know that he had been a war artist. I was aware of him as a sort of arch avant-gardist and vorticist and so on.
Let's just ask each of you, if I may, to describe a work that for you either epitomises or is an important work. Richard, you begin if you would, please.
As an art curator at the Imperial War Museum, I'm almost duty-bound to say a battery shelled. And this is a British battery being shelled by their sort of opposite numbers, the Germans. And in the background, you see the battery in the process of being bombarded. And what you see are many sort of quite robotic, almost sort of insectivorous forms scuttling away for cover. These are the British artillerymen. On the left, you see three large, more naturalistic foreground figures looking at what is going on before them. It's a very unusual, enigmatic painting.
John, what about you?
Well, paradoxically, as a war artist, the one that springs to mind for me is his self-portrait as a tyro, nothing to do with his period as depicting war. And the reason is, I just found the painting hilarious. It is absolutely hilarious. And I think this sort of sums something up about Wyndham Lewis for me, in that if you look at his portraits, there's a kind of humanity and a tenderness. in that. And I believe that I understand that many of the portraits he undertook really just to earn some money. But this particular portrait, done in that sort of rather avant-garde style, is bizarre, slightly clunky, with his exposed teeth, its angular shapes. It just makes me laugh. And I don't think that was his intention, actually.
Anna?
Well, I was lucky enough to see the exhibition in Salford yesterday. And one of the things which was very striking about it was the fact that they were able to borrow works from far away. And one, in fact, came from Melbourne in Australia called The Inferno, 1937, which is an extraordinary painting, not only because it's extraordinary in its own right, but because it represents a red column of fire with figures falling out of it and dead and dying bodies at the bottom of it. And of course, given the events in London of the last week, it was an extremely telling image for me, one which I found very distressing to look at, but also completely fascinating because it's so powerful.
Now, it's so far we've talked of him as an artist. Mm. What I want, before we go on, though, to talk about his work, is to think of his biography. And he was a self-declared rebel, Richard, and rebels tend to come from within the class.
Well, I mean, Lewis really was born from outside of Britain. He came to Britain through his father's obsession with yachting. I mean, he was born, whether you believe the myth or not, either off the coast of Canada or in Amherst in Nova Scotia. I mean, he was a great myth maker. I don't think he was necessarily from within the establishment. Okay, he was educated at Rugby for a while and then was educated as a slave for a while, but then sort of left that, went travelling in Europe to sort of formulate his own artistic education.
So. Anna, do you want to add to that?
I'm intrigued by his origins because he clearly wasn't absolutely certain what they were. And he was also very attracted to the idea of North America. He makes repeated trips to New York. He then ends up staying in the United States and also Canada for a period of 6 years. But he made a place for himself in that world. And I think he is someone who is, you know, what someone we would now describe as transnational. He is a global person in that sense. He's not a nationalist, rather amazingly.
John? I think maybe, for me, perhaps that explains his status and self-proclaimed status as a rather sort of pugilistic, hostile avant-gardist. It sits very uncomfortably with the very sort of English response to modernism and so on. You see it more in common with the futurists or something like that. That idea of a movement with a manifesto making bold statements like that, it's not something that is really characteristic of English art.
And is it also true, if we widen it to the culture, I'm thinking of Owen's famous phrase, the poetry is in the pity. It seems to me as if Wyndham Lewis had read that and decided to oppose it, Richard.
I think in some ways the way that he's quite sort of distanced and detached from what he is, there is this sort of absence of forced sentiment that I think somehow that can actually sort of work to sort of generate that sort of emotive response.
John?
But for me, I think that's why I don't respond to him as an artist for the most part. It's that core of humanity somehow. And I mentioned before the portraits, you know, which he did later on, which there is something there. But certainly much of the work that he's famous for and is sort of part in the art history books for, I find a lot of it rather clumsy, compositionally awkward, which in spite of the fact he was an extraordinarily accomplished draftsman. Maybe that's part of what works for it, but it doesn't for me.
Anna?
Yeah, well, I think he's a brilliant artist because of the ideas in the picture. He's not a fantastic painter. He's not a painter like Vanessa Bell, who just had a feeling for paint. He's never like that. And he certainly, in the early years, he was far more comfortable making watercolours than oil paintings. So he's not a natural painter. But the ideas which come out of these works, particularly the ones in the 1930s, which I must confess I didn't know as well as I might, simply because they're not in this country. They were sent to various...
What sort of ideas are you...
Well, this picture, Inferno, which seemed very opportune at the moment, if that is the correct word, is a picture which is about the complete chaos that he felt was going on in Europe in the 1930s. He was terrified of the idea of another war coming. He sensed this kind of almost apocalyptic moment which he felt was about to happen.
Which for someone who was an aficionado of Hitler in the early days, it's sort of... interesting.
That's true, but I think that that's, unfortunately, a very bad mistake.
One doesn't want to nail him anyway for this. It's not simply that he was pro-Hitler for a time, but he was rabidly and consistently anti-communist, wasn't he?
He was anti-communist. Yeah. He was also fascinated by things which were new. And this is one of the things which attracts him to futurism, first of all, is that it's new, it's dynamic, it's exciting. He goes to Germany in 1931. He sees what's happening in Germany. He doesn't completely understand it. He thinks that Hitler will never start another war because he was in the First War. And he's wrong. Mm. And, you know, eventually he looks for copies of that book and burns them.
I wonder if we could, and I think this is Hemingway's famous quote in A Movable Feast, which I remember, which is, Wyndham Lewis had the eyes of an unsuccessful rapist, which is as nasty a comment. Now, the interesting bit for that, for me, is it raises the issue of masculinity. Mm. And masculinity and modernism are really very closely allied in all kinds of ways. I mean, Anna, do you think there is something kind of cruel but accurate in what Hemingway says?
I'd always thought that Lewis was a misogynist, and I've changed my mind. I read the reviews that he wrote for The Listener quite recently and was really intrigued to see what he had to say about people like Barbara Hepworth, Gwen John. Incredibly generous, very positive reviews about their work. And he's always very sympathetic to women artists. So
I assume he is, but I take it what Hemingway is in effect saying is the way he looks at the world in the paintings is actually cold and distant and about power, his power, which goes back to what John was saying about the scuttling figures that one sees.
I mean, it's difficult to know precisely what Hemingway meant. I mean, it could be interpreted in different ways. I mean, and frustrated in what his evil machinations, perhaps.
Richard, how do you interpret it?
I think he just didn't like him.
He called him all sorts
of other things, like the measuring worm and things like that. I mean, he clearly, Lewis was someone who got under his skin, basically.
When he was in North America during the war, Hemingway was very helpful to him. He came across him again, and that seems to be one of the characteristics of all of Lewis's friendships. He says awful things about people, and he did, in fact, start that war of words. And then they forgive him and they think he's wonderful again. Mm.
So, if we can now think of Lewis now, in Tate Modern you have a particular account of what counts of modernism and modernity. You know, sometimes, and you'll forgive me for asking this, Richard, Lewis gets the Imperial War Museum because the Tate won't give him a one-person show because he doesn't quite fit the narrative. So I'm interested how you think he fits into the story of modernism and how he shakes it up, if he does at all.
It's quite difficult, really, with Lewis, because he very much was a hostage to fortune, and you can speculate to the cows come home about what vorticism might have been had the First World War not intervened. But he has been sort of regarded as something kind of quite a bit of an anomaly, I suppose, particularly in his, you know, his standpoint. Some of his critiques of the 1920s very sort of cut against the sort of the modernist literature of Joyce, of Stein, of Wolfe, etc. Proust, for example.
I think that there's also another problem, which is that Lewis is stuck with that label of vorticist, and his work changes very dramatically after the war, as it did for many other artists. And we have absolutely no problem about that when looking at Picasso. But for some reason, it does seem to be a problem when addressing the later work of Lewis. And I was absolutely intrigued by all the late 1930s paintings simply because it was so clear to me that he'd been looking very, very hard at all those surrealist exhibitions that took place in London in the 1930s. And yet they're not mentioned because Lewis doesn't label himself a surrealist and he didn't exhibit in any of those exhibitions. And yet they fed his imagination. And we talk about this lack of humanity, but when we look at Dali's work, we don't complain because it doesn't have that quality. And I think in a sense...
Some of us do.
Some of us do, yes. I'm not a great Dali fan, but yes. It's a kind of, to my mind, a rather English way of looking at work.
John?
Well, for me, he is, yes, he's a sort of interesting curiosity. But I think, you know, there are always going to be those types because we are obliged to see some sort of history narrative of modernism and whether, you know, do people sit within certain movements, certain periods, certain tendencies. And it's never as clear-cut as that. It doesn't really fit the sort of curatorial mindset, sadly, but you know, that such is the nature of artists, they refuse to be pigeonholed.
They
like
are
that.
Cussed people, and I want, if we may, to spend a little time with you, really, as an official war artist. I mean, Louis said he came from a military caste, and of course, you've spent a lot of your time making paintings about the period in which he was active, and also your own family has got, if not a military caste, war connections. Is that important, you think, of an artist, that somehow there is a kind of family connection?
To me, it was almost kind of subconscious, I think. I mean, it wasn't deliberate. And it's only sort of in my slightly more mature years that I reflected upon, you know, the time that I was born, the fact that both my parents had been alive, survived the war, my father as a prisoner of war, my mother losing her first husband in Normandy. It was just part of the landscape. It wasn't something I particularly felt was part of me. But it's only on reflection that you see yourself in that longer context of history unfolding.
What is it? Because obviously we're going back to the early 20th century a lot. What is it? I remember a sequence of paintings of yours of the early Soviet Union figures. What is it that takes you back to that period makes it feel our period?
They were paintings made from the mugshots of people arrested by the NKVD who would very soon, no doubt, be executed. And I was just fascinated. It's the humanity of those images set against the ruthlessness of the regime. A regime, of course, that was supposed to be to better humanity, but at the same time, individual humans did not matter at all. And it's that sort of that paradox that sort of fascinates and appalls me.
I understand that, but you could have gone elsewhere in history and you went to that point, so don't try and get away with it that easily.
I could have done, but this is sort of, it seems very recent in a way. It's still relevant. And it also, I suppose, perhaps now ideology doesn't exist in the same way it did in those days. So, and I'm interested in that idea of the failure of ideology to produce what it affects to desire. And that, it seems, it's a very tangible, recent and, for me, very powerful period in history of terrible things.
It's also the case that when Lewis was a war artist in the First World War, obviously there were films coming back from the front, but the density of images we have of war now is unimaginable to Lewis. What does a war artist do when actually on the nearest click of a button I can see almost any horrendous act I want?
It's rendered that job incredibly difficult. I mean, at the time, I was a war artist during the first Gulf War in 1991. It was the early days of satellite technology and so on, but certainly not of the internet and mass dissemination of images that we now have. It's very, very difficult to make sense of that. It is very challenging. I mean, I have, in recent work of my own, attempted to address some of the horror obliquely of some of the images that have been common currency within the last few years. And it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very fine line to draw between commenting on something without indulging in voyeurism or anything rather unpleasant like that. So it's a difficult one. It's a very challenging time.
John Keane, thank you very much indeed. And of course, my thanks also to Richard Slocum and to Anna Gretzner-Robbins. Wyndham Lewis Life, Art, War runs at the Imperial War Museum North in Manchester until the 1st of January 2018. What sense can we make of death or of the way it impacts on the way we live our lives? Well, the philosopher Simon Beard has set down his thoughts in a postcard, one of a series by our new generation thinkers.
The physicist Robert J. Oppenheimer is said to have greeted the dawning of the nuclear age, the coming of that time in which humanity had gained the capacity to bring about its own destruction, with the following passage from the Bhagavad Gita. I am death, the mighty destroyer of the world, ancient of days, come here to consume. Yet, though they heralded a concern very much of our own time, these words express one of the deepest fears we have, the fear of senseless and inevitable death. Many philosophers have disagreed with the common view that death is malevolent, or even destructive as such. The philosopher Derek Parfit, my own great mentor, who himself died earlier this year, argued that it's wrong to say that in the future I will be dead, but only that there will be no one living who will be me. Our lives, on his view, are complete unto themselves, yet as people we are woven into a web of interconnected psychological being that is not so easily destroyed. Death, it is true, has many downsides. It limits our ability to achieve our goals and fulfill our potential. It robs our family and friends of someone they love, and it foreshortens our capacity to learn about and hence to understand ourselves and the world around us. Such costs are not to be laughed at, yet, to me, they have always only ever been half the story. For death is not without its benefits as well, and its costs are not so great as they may at first seem. Whilst our lives come to an end, death allows the world to renew itself, and hence for our hopes and dreams to live on in the lives of others, albeit to a lesser extent, perhaps, than they did in our own. Since we have but little time to live, we are forced to make hard choices and to decide who we want to be. We are given the power to mould our futures through the decisions that we make and are saved from the perils of forever being forced to live out their consequences. Yes, we may have been able to achieve more were we to live forever, but such achievements would lack the thrill of our hard-won victories, dragged from the clutches of our encroaching demise. But what of the termination, not only of individual lives, but of whole civilizations or even species? It is sometimes said that one death is a tragedy, a million deaths are only a statistic. However, I find the opposite to be the case. I work in the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge, researching threats to humanity's survival, including what we might do to ourselves through nuclear war, overpopulation and climate change. Such catastrophes are hard to imagine and even harder to respond to, but their tragedy would be far greater than numbers alone can illustrate. To say that in the future there will be no one living is surely much worse than to say simply that there will be no one living who will be me. Death's consolations rest, as Derek Parfit suggested, on the fact that others survive us and on that greater whole of which we are but a part. With the death of a generation, a community, a nation, a people or a species, we lose not just all the individuals that make up that group, but the values and beliefs, the ambitions and desires, and the hopes and dreams that bound them together and drove them forward. The loss of all that potential, though it may seem of little importance in our own lives, is something that we should all fear and do much more to prevent.
I'm interested that you begin your postcard with the idea that this technology brings death, or at least the idea of death, into the world. And of course, you know, and in fact you imply, if you look back to the 19th century, John Stuart Mill thinks entropy is going to end the world. In Edmund Gosse's Father and Son, Philip Gosse rails against God because the end of the world has not come as it should have gone. And Malthus, whom you will know very well, depending on which version you read, says that, as it were, catastrophe and famine and other things. So what I'm interested in is this sense of epochal and general death of humanity. Is this just something we've always had to live with?
Something changed around 1945, around the end of the Second World War. Before then, people were worried about apocalypse. Now, the earliest fears about apocalypse were all about supernatural beings, things totally beyond our control, ending humanity. Then we got to a point where we understood how natural systems worked. We understood the laws of physics. We understood ecological laws and our need for nutrition and so on, as Malthus did. And we started to worry, well, maybe they might end civilization.
This kind of evolutionary account, yeah. There are still religious people who think the world's
absolutely
going to end, and scientific laws are endlessly being upended.
And these things build on each other, one upon another upon another. And we have very old fears here that keep on coming back again and again.
So tell me what happens in 45.
Something changed towards the end of the Second World War. And that is, we not just worked out that the world might end, we worked out how to end it. And actually, it turns out that in about three or four different ways, we worked out how to end our own species for the first time. So at the same time, we developed nuclear weapons, with the capacity to blow us to kingdom come. We developed the techniques to genetically engineer diseases and create pandemics. And we also started to get the idea that we could use these in a military context. We industrialized the whole world. We increased the global population and industrial output about tenfold in a very short period of time and brought about the Anthropocene, this stage we're in where not only the environment but our very geology is being determined by our own actions. Okay, so and we also developed artificial intelligence.
Explain to me why we seem to live so relatively relaxed with these apocalyptic scenarios that we've been produced for our own destruction.
People often don't notice that we are living in different times. So when someone comes forward and says, here's something that we should worry about, right? From avian influenza, artificial intelligence, nuclear weapons or something, people take it seriously for a while. But then it just falls back into the mist of those ancient fears of something out there. And we don't realize that now it really is something in here. And we do need to keep on worrying about it. This isn't superstition. This is our own agency.
Good old scientific precision. Superstition, you can't dismiss the whole of religion as superstition, or maybe you can.
People dismiss beliefs because they mistake them for superstition. I don't label anything. I only try to answer the question of why it is that we seem to be able to live with the situation that we're in. One of the things that religion has spent a long time worrying about is whether we can call death, death. It's been trying to outline ways in which death is not what it seems, ways in which we might survive death. I am worried about actual ends, and that is incompatible with a second coming, with heaven and hell. These things are not actually death, so they don't speak to our fears.
But most of the postcard isn't about that. Most of the postcard is trying to work out how death gives meaning to our life. And that death, the fact it's a finite life, in an odd way has benefits as well as has limitations.
Sure.
A third century Christian killing themselves to get to God earlier, or a suicide bomber blowing themselves up. Both those make sense of the life. So how do you adjudicate between the ways death makes sense of life that are morally acceptable and the ways that aren't?
Death gives meaning to life because it allows us to make decisions about who we are. We are morally responsible for those decisions. Death can give meaning to life even if you decide that you want to be a horrible person, right? And you would not have that choice. If you tried to be a horrible person, but you were immortal, you would change. The world would change you. You would end up the opposite of what you wanted to be. That is just an inevitability of how we interact with the world around us.
Do you know Tennyson's Tithonus? Tithonus is a human being who is given immortal life, but because he doesn't work out that he should have asked for immortal youth. So he's on the edge between life and death, and he wants death. Do you think in the end that's what we all want, death? In your sense of it, something final, complete?
No. I think that we want life, but I think that we want that life to be finite. If you had an infinitely prolonged life, that would be a burden that would be very hard to bear. So it is better that life is cut short. But that does not mean we long for death, because death is not something that we can have in that sense.
Who is the we? You're speaking of human species, including China and India and Indonesia and Japan. But how can you speak of those? This isn't an objection to you. It's an objection to a certain way of conceiving of philosophy.
When we talk about death, it is a very universal thing, and it was wrong to talk about it just in terms of I, and right to talk about it in terms of we. It is not any one individual who will cause the demise of our civilization. It will be a collective act. It may be a collective act of evil intention. It may be a collective act of ignorance. It may be a collective act of failure to recognize or respond to the threats that we face. Probably it will involve all three of those things.
Do you think it will happen? Do you think it will happen? Because Malthus thought it would probably happen.
I know that it could, and that's enough to worry me.
New Generation thinker Simon Beard. You can find more short talks and films made by our New Generation thinkers on the Free Thinking website. Next week, I'll be back on Tuesday speaking to the playwright Robert Lepage and to the stand-up comedian Catherine Ryan for the first in a week of special Canadian programmes as part of Radio 3's Canada 150 season. Join me then.